evening news. But first, KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Natural Grocers, which is donating 2.5% of company-wide sales this MLK Day to the Jack and Jill Gap Fund for historically black colleges and universities.
Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years, a day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor kick off 2020 on Friday, January 17th. They are co-lead singers and primary songwriters for the Grammy Award-winning O'Connor Band. That's Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, Friday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m., doors at 7, at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Equal Rights Amendment was ratified in Virginia today, putting the amendment's constitutional future back on the table.
Lawmakers plan to demand ICE release its trans detainees.
And in international news, the government of Russia has resigned.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, January 15, 2020. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Today, Virginia became the 38th state to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment, and in doing so, could put the amendment's constitutional future back on the table. Women packed the galleries of the state capitol, and some lawmakers brought their daughters to witness this historic vote. Constitutional amendments require two-thirds of states to ratify them, or 38 out of 50, and they also must pass through Congress. The Equal Rights Amendment was first proposed in 1923, promising equal rights for women, stating that the laws of the land cannot be denied or abridged on account of sex. The ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment had a deadline set by Congress for 1982, and that date passed without enough states signing on to the amendment. For the first time in 25 years, Virginia Democrats won control of both houses of the state legislature, and the state has now passed the ERA. The amendment faces an uncertain future since the two-thirds state requirement comes after the deadline imposed by Congress. However, Congress does not need to set the deadlines for ratification, and indeed some have said it does not even have the power to do so. Congress could repeal the act that imposed the deadline and push for ratification, though there are plenty of opponents and confusion surrounding its legality.
Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has declared a state of emergency after what he described as credible intelligence of threats of violence from far-right groups at an upcoming gun rights rally. The governor said at a press conference Wednesday that authorities believe, quote, armed militia groups plan to storm the Capitol during the rally set to take place in Richmond on January 20th. The governor also said that threats and, quote, extremist rhetoric were very similar to what was observed prior to the violent Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in August of 2017. The state of emergency will temporarily ban individuals from carrying any weapons on Capitol grounds, and that includes firearms. The weapons ban will most likely cause some derision among the 5,000 to 10,000 gun lovers expected to attend the rally, which was billed as an open carry event. The January 20th event, called Lobby Day, was organized by the Virginia Citizens Defense League, a pro-Second Amendment nonprofit, in response to new gun control legislation that has been recently introduced by the state legislature. Several armed militia groups planning to attend the event have described it as, quote, boogaloo, a term that the far right uses to describe a second civil war.
In an unprecedented move, 45 congressional Democrats will demand the immediate release of all transgender people in ICE detention centers. Illinois Representative Mike Quigley last week circulated a sign-on letter stating that ICE violates its own guidelines by putting trans people in solitary confinement for, quote, protective purposes, end quote, substantially raising the risk of assault by ICE guards. The letter is addressed to Acting ICE Director Matthew Albence and Department of Homeland Security Acting Secretary Chad Wolf, and accuses ICE of failing to comply with a 2015 memo that details the care of transgender detainees. The memo specifically mandates that trans detainees cannot be placed in solitary confinement for their own safety unless no other options exist. It also requires that trans detainees be consulted about what housing would make them feel safest. Quigley said in a statement, quote, trans men and women experience a higher threat of sexual violence and are too frequently placed in solitary confinement. If ICE cannot provide appropriate and humane accommodations, they must release them from detention. No one else should have to lose their lives because of ICE's cruel mismanagement, end quote. The move for accountability comes after the deaths of two transgender detainees, Roxana Hernandez in 2018 and Johanna Medina León in 2019. The letter demands that ICE present a detailed plan for compliance with the memo by January 27th. According to the Center for American Progress, LGBTQ immigrants are 97 times more likely to be sexually assaulted in detention.
According to an annual temperature report published on Wednesday by NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, 2019 was the second hottest year ever, capping off the hottest decade ever recorded in history. The cause, scientists say, is very clearly human-emitted greenhouse gases, and they warn the world won't be able to reverse the damage, urging governments and corporations to take action now. For the first time ever, the average temperature in Alaska was above freezing. Temperatures in Australia were recorded at 1.5 degrees Celsius above normal, an increase that has been repeatedly cited as an obvious contributor to the devastating bushfires the continent has been facing. In addition to the high temperatures recorded around the planet, glaciers continue to melt at record rates in Greenland and the far north. The temperature increases reported on Wednesday confirm that the warming trend is real and measurable, and the numbers have been verified by other studies around the world. The 2015 Paris Climate Agreement was intended to urge governments to take action to keep global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius. The global temperature rise in 2019 was 1.15 degrees Celsius. At 2 degrees Celsius, more than 410 million people are expected to have no access to clean water. The oceans were also recorded as absorbing more heat in 2019 than ever before, the equivalent of 5 Hiroshima bombs worth of heat every minute, continuously. Gavin Schmidt, director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, said, quote, we derive no joy from reporting the same story every year, but we're going to keep doing the same story until we get emissions under control.
Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev and the rest of the country's government have resigned in the wake of President Vladimir Putin's proposed constitutional amendments to reshape the government. A key change would limit the power of future Russian presidents, including limiting the president to 2 terms should Putin, now in his 4th term, step down in 2024. In power since 2000, the 67-year-old Putin has ruled Russia longer than anyone since Stalin and plans to stay in power even when he is no longer president. The broad move came shortly after Putin gave his annual address to Russian lawmakers, which included proposed changes that would transfer more power to parliament. The events of today have been called, quote, absolutely unprecedented.
President Donald Trump's impeachment trial took a major step forward as the House of Representatives voted, largely along party lines, to send two articles of impeachment to the Senate. Speaker Nancy Pelosi had held the already approved articles for a month, hoping, unsuccessfully, to get clear rules from Mitch McConnell about how the trial would be conducted in the Senate. McConnell said the Senate would take up, quote, housekeeping items relating to impeachment this week, including whether or not witnesses will be called, and hold opening arguments next Tuesday. This morning, Pelosi named the seven impeachment managers who will prosecute the case against Trump at the Senate trial. Led by Chairs Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler, the committee also includes Representatives Jason Crow of Colorado, Val Demings of Florida, Sylvia Garcia of Texas, Hakeem Jeffries of New York, and Zoe Lofgren of California. Chief Justice Roberts will preside over the impeachment trial.
Last night, House Democrats released a trove of Ukraine-related documents they obtained from Lev Parnas, a close associate of President Donald Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani. Representative Elliot Engel, chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, said the messages are, quote, profoundly alarming, end quote, and, quote, suggest a possible risk, end quote, to former Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch's security in Kyiv before she was recalled to Washington. Also among the documents is a screenshot of a previously undisclosed letter from Giuliani to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky requesting a meeting with Zelensky as, quote, personal counsel to President Trump and with his knowledge and consent, end quote. The documents provide more evidence of Trump's and Giuliani's intent to force Zelensky to investigate presidential hopeful Joe Biden and his son, as well as to remove Ambassador Yovanovitch from her post. These actions are at the core of the two articles of impeachment delivered to the Senate today.
Six candidates took the stage last night at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, to debate issues ahead of the Iowa caucus on February 3rd. With that story and more, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
I think the best way to talk about who can win is by looking at people's winning record. So, can a woman beat Donald Trump? Look at the men on this stage. Collectively, they have lost 10 elections. The only people on this stage who have won every single election that they've been in are the women.
Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders agreed at last night's CNN Des Moines Register Democratic debate that a woman can win the presidency, though they disagree about what was said during a private meeting in 2018.
Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by 3 million votes. How could anybody in a million years not believe that a woman could become president of the United States?
Six candidates took last night's stage in Des Moines: Elizabeth Warren, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and Tom Steyer. Civilly, candidates discussed health care, education, child care, and whether to pass the new NAFTA, an important issue in the Hawkeye state with billions in exports depending on its approval. Sanders opposes the new trade deal.
Every major environmental organization has said no to this new trade agreement because it does not even have the phrase climate change in it.
And so does Tom Steyer, who's made climate change his top priority, but also had to confront his history with coal, oil, and gas.
Over 10 years ago, I realized that there was something going on that had to do with fossil fuels that we had to change. So I divested from fossil fuels. I took the giving pledge to give most of my money away while I'm alive. And for 12 years, I've been fighting the climate crisis.
When challenged about his support among Black voters, Pete Buttigieg listed some of the African-American politicians who've endorsed him, including Mayor Quentin Hart of Waterloo, Iowa, where one of the state's largest Black populations resides.
The Black voters who know me best are supporting me. It's why I have the most support in South Bend. It's why among elected Black officials in my community who have gotten into this race, by far most of them are supporting me.
Responding to a question about supporters who fear Warren might alienate swing voters, she pushed a message of unity.
Two of my three brothers are Republicans. And sure, there are a lot of things we disagree on, and we can take to our corners and do the Democratic-Republican talking points. But the truth is, there's a whole lot we agree on.
But right out of the gate, as expected, was Iran and national security. Biden and Sanders had a lengthy back and forth on the war in Iraq, and Buttigieg put forth the need for 21st century foreign policy. Here's what Klobuchar had to say.
Donald Trump is taking us pell-mell toward another war. We have a very important resolution. We just found out today that four Republicans are joining Democrats to go to him and say, you must have an authorization of military force if you're going to go to war with Iran.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
Opponents and supporters of the Keystone XL pipeline testified at a South Dakota water use hearing this week. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Supporters and opponents of the Keystone XL pipeline summarized 11 days of testimony before the South Dakota Water Management Board Tuesday. Attorneys for the South Dakota Water Rights Program and TC Energy hold that state law limits the board's consideration specifically to the use of water during pipeline construction. But opponents, including tribal citizens, say the board has an obligation to consider potential water contamination and health consequences after the pipeline is finished. Victoria Wicks reports.
Ann Mines Bailey represents the State Water Rights Program. She says the Water Management Board's authority is limited to one chapter of state law.
Title 46 is about the appropriation of water. It's about setting aside water for a very specific use. It's not about water quality.
Mines Bailey says public interest considerations must be limited to pipeline construction, not what happens after the pipeline is finished. And she notes that the statute does not provide for consideration of an applicant's character or past acts. But the attorney for the Rosebud Sioux Tribe and Great Plains Tribal Water Alliance says that's exactly what the board should do. Peter Capicella says the only way to translate tribal concerns is by examining risk, and past actions can help with that. He tells the board that the Federal Pipeline Safety Agency has determined that the leak detection used by TC Energy is effective only 23% of the time.
So we have, like in Freeman, the leak actually going on for days or weeks, or we don't know how long, and then the landowner discovers it.
He says Keystone XL can carry up to 830,000 barrels a day.
The leak detection threshold of 1%, what that means is 8,300 barrels of oil can leak every day in the waters of South Dakota if this project gets built, and nobody will know.
The board heard testimony from two attorneys supporting the pipeline permit and four attorneys and three pro se interveners against it. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Nevada tribes discuss priorities at the Four Directions and Nevada Tribal Nations Native American Presidential Forum 2020 in Las Vegas Tuesday. Leaders from seven of Nevada's 27 tribes took to the stage to talk about protecting sovereignty, economic development, and other issues. Arlen Melendez, chairman of the Reno Sparks Indian Colony, says health care is of top concern.
When you really think about everyday life, I think it's health care. Because there's not a day that goes by that somebody on our reservation isn't sick or just passed away. And so, as you know, the Affordable Health Care Act is really important to us. Here in the state of Nevada, you know, when we talk about health care, you know, there's a lot of changes that are going through Congress. There's changes in the nation.
Chairman Anthony Sampson of the Pyramid Lake Paiute Tribe says one of the biggest health care needs for Nevada tribes is a hospital.
We see all the rest of the Indian nations in the Southwest building hospitals, but we don't have one here. We need one that is centrally located in the state of Nevada that can serve our 27 tribes in Nevada state and the surrounding areas also. When you look at it, we are underfunded, and we do need Congress to fully appropriate IHS so that we can maybe create our own area office.
The tribal leaders say they're looking to members of Congress and the next administration to guard Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act and fully fund tribal health care programs. Nevada tribes and the group Four Directions are hosting the two-day event, which includes voter training and panels with candidates running for president. Independent candidate Mark Charles, who's Navajo, attended the forum in person Tuesday. Attendees are expected to hear from four Democratic candidates Wednesday. Organizers say all candidates running for president were invited. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Julia DeGraw has announced her campaign to fill the Portland City Council seat left vacant after the death of Commissioner Nick Fish earlier this year. a special election to fill Fish's seat will take place during the May 19th Democratic primary. DeGraw is a progressive organizer and water rights activist, as well as a critic of Portland's century-old commissioner form of government. She is the director of PDX Forward, a nonprofit that lobbies for progressive government policies like campaign finance reform and creating a public bank. Prior to that, DeGraw spent a decade at the nonprofit Food and Water Watch and helped lead the campaign to keep a Nestle bottling plant out of the Columbia River Gorge. She previously ran against Fish in May 2018, but never saw Fish as a rival, saying, quote, "I genuinely agree with his values. I believe government can play an incredible role in solving society's problems," end quote. DeGraw is only one of several progressives with eyes on the council seat, which includes tenants' rights activist Margot Black, Metro Councilor Sam Chase, and City Hall staffer Cynthia Castro, while former Portland Mayor Sam Adams and former Multnomah County Commissioner Loretta Smith are reportedly considering running.
According to several sources, former Mayor Sam Adams is closing in on a return bid for a city council seat on the May ballot. Some close to Adams have urged him to challenge Mayor Ted Wheeler or City Commissioner Chloe Udaly. Wheeler recently lost his campaign manager, announced he's getting divorced, and has done little to raise money for his reelection bid. Udaly hasn't hired a campaign manager or filled out paperwork required to qualify for public financing. Another seat will be vacant, as City Commissioner Amanda Fritz plans to retire after three terms. According to some, his most likely target is the seat left vacant by Commissioner Nick Fish, who died on January 2nd of this year. Adams, who is 56, was mayor from 2009 to 2013, and as mayor, extended the Portland streetcar to the east side, expanded bicycle infrastructure, introduced curbside composting, and brought the Portland Timbers back to town. Following Adams' departure, he worked at the World Resources Institute, a global nonprofit whose mission is to promote environmental sustainability. Some controversy has followed the former mayor after a sexual harassment accusation in 2017 from Adams's former mayoral scheduler, as well as a relationship with a young intern during his tenure.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo, your weekly look at the happenings inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy and windy with wind gusts up to 34 miles per hour and a low of 36. Tomorrow's weather is a 50% chance of rain with the wind down to between 6 and 11 miles per hour and a high of 42. Today in history, in 1929, Martin Luther King Jr. was born. He was assassinated on April 4th, 1968 at the age of 39. The quote of the day is from Dr. King. Quote, "I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word."
This week, Seattle's City Council voted unanimously to ban any, quote, foreign-influenced corporations from contributing to local elections. Foreign-influenced means the company has a single foreign investor holding at least 1% ownership or two or more foreign shareholders holding at least 5%. Before last November's election, Amazon contributed $1.5 million to the Seattle Chamber of Commerce's Super PAC. In 2018, Amazon lobbied to defeat a tax on large corporations aimed at raising revenue for homeless services and affordable housing. Ron Fine, legal director for Free Speech for People, said, quote, "Seattle's law should spark a national movement to protect our democratic self-government. If what Seattleites call the other Washington won't lead, then Seattle will."
The Trump administration's migrant protection protocols do everything but protect migrants. KABU reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu spoke with Mariah Carlson, who saw firsthand the situation on the border near Brownsville, Texas.
My name is Kathy Mariah Carlson. I go by Mariah, and I just came back from Brownsville, Texas, where the MPP is in place, which just means that stands for Migrant Protection Protocol. Believe me, they're not protecting the migrants, and these people aren't migrants, they're refugees. Anyway, I just came back from doing two different things down there. One was working with Team Brownsville, who has been feeding 1,000 people a day for about a year. Every night they feed them dinner. And so I helped do some cooking, and then after we cook on the U.S. side, then you load it into the car, then you take it to the bus station where you get these little wagons that you pull over and you go across the bridge, you walk them across the bridge, and then set up, there's a line set up, and then we serve the people. And then on Sunday, this past Sunday, they started, there's another thing happening down there. It's called Witness at the Border. And that is a program that started in Torino, Texas. They eventually shut down a child prison there by just going and witnessing, and then they moved to Homestead, Florida, and there was another for-profit child prison there, and they got that one shut down last August. And so the new target is Matamoros, which is the name of the town on the other side of the border from Brownsville, where right now there are about 2,500 people in this camp, and it's growing all the time. I got down there a couple weeks ago, and they said there was 2,200 in the camp, and then before I left, they said there was 2,500 in the camp. And about 500 of those are small children. We're talking about babies and preschool age. So it was supposed to be that the Mexican government was going to help take care of these people, but they really haven't so far. So Team Brownsville has got some grant money and matching funds, and they actually installed a water filtration system, and so they are now getting drinking water out of the Rio Grande. They don't have any place to shower. They have outhouses that frequently are way more full than they should be, and Team Brownsville has struggled to find a provider to pump the outhouses on a regular basis, and they've gone, they said 6 months, and now they finally have somebody that's actually doing what they say they're going to do. They have to pay a month in advance, and what was happening is they were paying, and then they'd come a couple times, and then they wouldn't come anymore. So they went through several of those. Everybody's trying to make money off these people. The Mexican government is, at first, when they started helping the people, they said we could only bring over used clothing. Now the Mexican government says they can only be new clothes, and you have to bring the receipt, and then the Mexican government charges 16% tariff on donations. So when you cross the border, you cross the bridge, this tent camp is right there. And so a couple of things are happening with that. The Mexicans have just recently said that we can't bring over any more tents. So they were providing tents for people, like every family would have a little tent. And now the government doesn't want that because they want to move these people so they're out of sight of the bridge, because the bridge, everybody can see them as they drive across, and thousands of people cross that bridge every day. Most of them, I think, are Americans coming back to the States. And, they want them out of sight, out of mind. So they want them to move up the hill and over the hill. And it would be much harder for our program to help them if they did that. And then they want to put them in giant tents, you know, that will serve like 100 or more, maybe 200. Those big, big, huge army tents that smell really bad and have no circulation. So that's what they want to put the people in. They don't want to move. And right now they do have their little individual tents, but it's been raining off and on, and so the tents are totally covered in plastic, which is good for rain, but not good when you think about they're sleeping in there. There's no ventilation going to set up you know, a really bad germ environment. There's, it could lead to mold. It could lead to, you know, not enough oxygen in the tents. You know, these little kids are growing. They need to be able to breathe.
Can you tell us anything about the, I guess they're called tent courts, or the immigration process itself there?
Oh, yeah, the tent courts, they also are right there by the border. So yesterday, I mean, on Sunday, as part of the Witness at the Border program I was involved with, we marched over there. They weren't open on Sunday, but we were greeted by Homeland Security guys that have these big vests and big guns, and, you know, they made us stay on the sidewalk and didn't know anything if you asked them a question. And so they go into these courts. They have 1 hour, if they're lucky, and they have no lawyers. And the judge is, I don't know where, but far, far away. And so they only see this flat screen TV. You know, that's who they're communicating with. So there's, it's pretty hard for the judge, I would think, to even get a sense of who these people are in that way. And 0.1% are being admitted. So that means that they've heard 10,000 cases and 11 people have been granted asylum. And one man was so distraught last week that he came out of the court, and as he crossed the bridge, he cut his throat.
Obviously, that's an absolutely terrible outcome. What happens to the other people who have their asylum or immigration cases denied?
They're kind of trapped. They can't go back home. That's why they came here in the first place. I mean, their stories are horrendous. You know, I met a little 14-year-old girl who was 5 months pregnant because of a rape, and that's why they had escaped Guatemala. And in Guatemala, there's no such thing as domestic violence or help for that, you know. And if you call the police and you've been raped, the police will rape you again. I know that people come to the border, they're seeking asylum, and these people are doing everything that they're being asked to do. They're totally legal. You know, they're waiting for this metering process, which means they only are allowed to seek asylum like maybe 5 or 6 for a day, for 1 day, and they have hundreds of people coming. So they have to wait in line to be able to seek the asylum, and then they go into the tents and wait again for their court date, which might get changed, and they might not find out about it. And if they miss it, that's their chance. It's gone.
So is there anything that our listeners can do to help or get involved or find out more information?
Oh, yeah. I suggest they go to Team Brownsville. They can just look that up on the Internet. You know, you can look and you can see what they're doing, how they could donate, how they could come down there and help. But, you know, you've got to write your senators and your congressmen and just keep rattling the cages.
This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu.